Welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. My name is Nicole Flattery. The Stinging Fly has been publishing new writers and new writing for the past 25 years. We take a particular interest in promoting the short story, and for this podcast, we ask a writer to root around our archive and pick out a story to read and discuss with me here. On this month's episode, I'm joined by the writer Gavin Corbish, who'll be reading from Rebecca Ivory's story, Arrivals, published in issue 45, volume 2 of The Stinging Fly. Arrivals was written as a one-night stand where four writers were commissioned to write a short story over the course of a single night. Those writers included Rebecca Ivory, Stephen Sexton, John McGregor, and Marie Helena Bertino. Four writers were invited to write a story from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m., and writers had to include four of these five words: bed, buried, velvet, river, and father. So that's how this story came about. Welcome, Gavin.
Thank you very much. I feel very welcome.
Do you feel very welcome?
I do.
I didn't introduce you properly. Gavin Corbett's novels include This Is the Way, which won the Kerry Group Irish Novel of the Year, and Green Glowing Skull. Hi.
It didn't win Green Glowing Skull.
You didn't
that
win
was,
it?
That was my second novel. Sorry, my third novel.
Your third novel?
It was my, yeah.
This podcast is just going hard here. My apologies.
I had a novel out in 2003. Yeah,
I think This Is the Way is the first novel I read.
Yeah, well, so. I kind of more or less disowned the first one, so it's the first novel in my mind as well.
We could talk about that. Would you like to read from the story first, Gavin?
Sure, why not? This is what I'm here for. Okay, so this is Arrivals by Rebecca Ivory. I won't read it all. I'll read the first couple of pages. I don't hear anything for 3 days, and then on Tuesday night, at the end of my shift at the restaurant, Dan leaves me two WhatsApp voice notes. One is 4.5 minutes long, and the next is a little over 2 minutes. He also sends three messages on Instagram, two reductress headlines and a meme about old people on Facebook. It's almost midnight for me, so 7 in the evening for him. I play his voice note while cycling home. I have had a truly awful day, he begins. He has been living in New York for 7 months and now uses truly an unnatural amount in conversation. I think he's picked this up from his American friends, but who am I to talk? Until recently, I was certain that amant was a real word, and I often say pacifically instead of specifically. Anyway, I am too critical of people who adopt the accent of the country that they're temporarily living in, as if it isn't normal or healthy for people to change depending on who they spend time with. I start the voice note from the beginning because I wasn't actually listening. My mind had wandered. I have had a truly awful day. This morning I was on the train and a couple started a flash mob. Actually, maybe it wasn't a flash mob. There was only the two of them swinging around the poles and twirling along the carriage. But anyway, they caused this huge distraction and everyone was clapping and cheering, and I just wanted to listen to Picture of You by Boyzone but couldn't hear it over the commotion. Then I started to think how great it would be if I could dance and if people clapped for me. So then I had this fantasy about me competing in one of those Strictly Come Dancing charity shows. You know, the ones that the local GAA clubs organise as their annual fundraiser. And that's a pathetic ambition, but I'm too old to ever be a real dancer, so I have to adjust my fantasies to meet my current potential. Because what's the point in a fantasy if there's no hope it will ever materialise? I let out a sloppy laugh, which must seem unbidden to the young couple I cycle past in the dark. I feel bad. I don't have a bike light, and I'm sure that's annoying for drivers and pedestrians. My boyfriend James thinks I replaced my broken light weeks ago, but I keep forgetting, and it's a weird lie that I keep telling, because I'm embarrassed that I can't reliably complete simple tasks. There are still several minutes of Dan's voice note left. Also, I met Pete at my lunch break, and I don't know what's going on there. I told him how upset I was that he ignored me for a week and that I couldn't be with someone who thought that was acceptable behaviour. Of course, I didn't expect him to agree. He said that he didn't think we should keep seeing each other because he didn't want to hurt me, because he cared about me. Obviously, I started to backtrack then because I was only trying to scare him, and the last thing I wanted was for him to call my bluff. And he was so sad, saying he had felt really good about us, so then I felt like I had made a huge mistake and was almost crying on my way back to the office. But listen, An hour later, he texted to say he didn't think he could stop seeing me and invited me to his apartment tonight. So honestly, I'd say he's full of shit, but I'm still really attracted to him, so I probably will have sex with him later. In the second voice note, he says he got a new job. He doesn't say exactly what it is, but it must be decent if he quit his job as studio assistant in Bushwick. In the final minute of his message, he says that he'll have 2 weeks off before he starts, and he's decided to visit home this weekend. I stop listening and start recording a reply. How long exactly are you home for? How much time will we get together? I still have a bell on my bike and ring it 3, 4, 5 times in excitement and stand up to pedal faster because as well as missing a light, my bike has only one gear. James is still up when I get home. Dan and I moved into this house when we started in NCAD together 7 years ago. After Dan left, James moved in with me. The house belongs to Dan's great aunt. She lives in a nursing home. We pay a tiny amount of rent to Dan's father. In return, we have to preserve the decor, which includes a lot of framed sacred hearts and images of baby Christ and tiny mounted figures depicting his waxy flushed face and thick lashes as he hangs on the cross, dying. I love it because I'm in the middle of a master's in fine art and find these knickknacks an endless source of inspiration for my projects. It's no different to collecting vintage teacups, but James doesn't like it. He's Protestant, although he says it's nothing to do with that. He's asthmatic, and these items gather a lot of dust. James is watching The Sopranos when I get home. He abruptly turns off the TV because he's not supposed to watch ahead without me. I lean down and hug him around his neck. Colleen, you stink of garlic mayonnaise. It's turning my stomach, he says, shaking me off. Dan is coming home next week. I do a little can-can dance and clap my hands under my leg as it flies mid-air. Next week? James asks, trying to grab my leg. Yeah, on Sunday, actually, I tell him. I might see if he wants to stay here for a couple of nights. Right, absolutely. It's his house. I might stay with Noel while he's here, though, he says. James and Dan are wary of each other, which is nice for me. I can always complain about one to the other. The only time it has bubbled over into outright animosity was at our graduation when James wore a pink velvet jacket with black silk lining. Dan asked James in front of my parents if he also smoked one of those novelty bubble pipes, and shortly afterwards, James slipped the coat off. I think the fact that he paid nearly €300 for it made it worse for him. I sit on the kitchen counter and text Dan, "Will you stay with me next week? James won't be around." James is still talking and then saying, "Colleen, Colleen, Colleen," in a monotone voice until I shout at him to stop. Dan replies, "Offended you felt the need to ask. Obviously, I will be staying with you. I lived there first." James accuses me of not listening to him until I insist that I am listening and ask, "Can he just repeat the last bit?" And I think I'll leave it there because although
thanks, Gavin.
Although it's not marked as a page break in this draft, it is in the final draft. So
it's a good overall view of that. First, this is interesting because I noticed when a lot of people come on the podcast, they pick stories that are sort of like their own work, and this is quite different to your work. What is it about this story that you?
When you asked me to appear on the podcast. Mm. I was determined not to read a story by someone, new and who everybody else was saying was exciting and who had a new book out to maybe promote. I was determined not to do that. I thought I'd do something by, somebody like Fred Johnson. I remember he had a great story in the Galway edition of the Stephen Fly, or Evelyn Conlon, or someone a bit kind of established, someone who's been writing for years and years and maybe who doesn't get their due, because there are lots of those people around. Lots of people, who've built up this great edifice of Irish literature over the last 50 years and they're still writing. Mm. And their books are coming out on tiny publishers and they get no attention at all when their stuff comes out. So I was determined to do something like that.
But you didn't.
But I didn't. because then Rebecca's book came out. Mm. Free Therapy.
Yeah,
Jonathan Cape.
It's a great book.
It's a great collection. Yeah. It's a great collection. And in one of the, I think it was a review or some, you know, kind of some, maybe an interview with Rebecca, I can't remember. I read that one of the stories in the collection, this one, Arrivals, began life as a draft that was published in the Stinging Fly.
Yeah, yeah.
It was written as part of this experiment that you talked about. And I remembered, I remember that story.
Yeah.
I remember that. I remember going to the launch. It was. I think it was November 21 edition, and the launch would have been around that time, or later 2021 anyway. And I just remember that event because it was one of the first kind of social events after COVID, just towards the, you know, the end of COVID.
Yeah.
And it was certainly the first literary event I'd been at in a couple of years. And there was a great, there was great joy in the room.
Yeah.
It's great for all the writers to come together again.
We love to come together.
We love, absolutely. And it was in Templebar Gallery and Studios, which you and I have very happy memories of.
Yeah.
Because we've both been writer in residence there in different years. And Rebecca got up and read this story. And I just remember thinking it was brilliant.
Yeah.
It was a brilliant story. And I was so impressed with how she and the other participants in this experiment had managed to knock out these, what seemed like just perfect, complete stories in just one night.
Yeah.
Impressive. So impressive, yeah. So I thought it'd be really interesting to read this and read the other one too, actually. Read the finished version and compare them, because I have that, you know, I have that sort of, I was an editor for years and I've taught creative writing. I've been writer in residence and, you know, Trinity and UCD and Galway, and so I'm really interested in drafting, and as a writer as well, as a you know, practicing writer, I'm really, really interested in drafting. So I was just interested to go back to the draft, which I hadn't read before. I'd only heard it, and cast my eye over the finished version. And really, not a huge amount has changed.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What's different?
Well, small things, right? But these small things are probably very, very important to Rebecca. And I could just imagine her listening to this and absolutely cringing and being in a rage that somebody is reading her first draft. Because it's really important, isn't it, to writers, that these small things that probably nobody else would notice are changed. You know, you're when you read back over your first draft, you're expecting these little kinks.
Yeah, oh, my first drafts are terrible, though.
Yeah.
What are your first drafts like?
Obviously dreadful. Dreadful.
Terrible,
obviously dreadful.
Painful stuff.
Yeah. But it was pretty much all there with Rebecca. I mean, all the events as they happen in the novel still happen in the sequence that they happen in the first draft. But I can see she's had another go at it, you know. I can see, again, little small, the punctuation marks, things that make such a difference to us, that we obsess over as writers. She's changed. Now I don't know how she's come up to these decisions to make these changes. I'm sure a lot of them she came to herself. Maybe she's had conversations with her, maybe certainly her editor, Zelika, I think, Marisovic.
Jekka.
Apologies, Jekka. And her agent, you know, because our agent has their say as well. Let's just assume that Rebecca just came to these decisions herself, because you will once you read back over your stuff and you mull over it. So little kind of judicious punctuation changes here and there definitely slowed it down a little bit. There are more pauses for breath in it. The first draft is obviously a little bit more breathless.
That was probably just because...
That's because, exactly, she was riding the...
You'd feel like...
She was riding the caffeine and the Benzedrine or whatever she'd taken that night. Yeah, no, she was rushing to get it out. Yeah, it's like Jack Kerouac or something. You're staying up all night and just banging it out. Yeah. And
I've never done this, by the way. I was thinking when I was reading it, I was like, I wonder what it would be like to give myself a constraint like that. I've never.
Yeah.
I'm always being like, I need to do X amount of drafts and things. And when I talk about writing, I talk about drafting all the time. But I wonder what it would be like to just do an experiment.
Yeah.
Like this.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never done it myself. Mm. I don't think. No. I've done it in small sections in my novels and stuff. I've like, you know, usually under the threat of a contract being cancelled, and I've got to hurry up with this. I'm just, I'm actually, invariably, they're the best bits.
Yeah.
They are the best bits. They just come out because we're all natural storytellers, and we obsess over things sentence by sentence, and then we forget the forward propulsion. And but sometimes you just, if you know, we can all sit down and tell a story to somebody. And one of the exercises I used to give to students in creative writing classes was, if you're stuck, just tell a story of somebody telling a story.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because it's much easier to paraphrase. And the draft comes out shaped, already shaped. Like a monologue. And it comes out naturally, because we want to hold that person's attention. You're aware of that person who's telling the story to the recipient. Of the need for that person to hold that person's attention, you know. And if the person listening needs to butt in, you'll know where they need to butt in. Like, there's some little point of like causality or something that they need teasing out, you know.
It's such a theatre trick.
I know. I sound like, what's his name? Mike Lee or what's the guy who taught Marlon Brando and all those method actors.
Eli Kazan.
It is a trick, but it's very practical.
It is so practical, because the hardest thing to write is overlapping dialogue. So like all that, and moving people around the space. So, but a monologue, it's such a moment of high intensity
you get the monologue and it comes out in this perfect shape.
Yeah, yeah.
It has a natural arc.
Mm.
It has a climax. We can all tell jokes, right?
Yeah, yeah. Not everyone.
Yeah, and it you know, peaks the right moment and just kind of glides out at the right moment. Yeah. And you've got this little, you know, those little toys you get in pound shops or euro shops. I should say, the little. It's like grow your own girlfriend or grow your own, I don't know, astronaut.
I didn't know you could get one of these.
There's these tiny little figures. They're like you know, they're an inch high.
Yeah.
And you just add water.
Yeah.
And like, they're just perfectly shaped, but then you add water and they just grow to 10 times the size. So you get this little, you get this little kind of nugget of a story. And, you know, you've already got an idea of, you know, by what proportion it needs to be scaled up. Because the shape is there, you know, and all you have to do then is just add oxygen, just dramatize the scenes, turn your bits of monologue into dialogue, keep the bits of exposition where you just want to warp speed through a section, because you get then the idea of pacing. But the danger is you will lose something essential in the tinkering around as well. The danger is, because there's always something really, really essential comes through in that first draft where you just have to rush. It's quite often voice, you know, you just grab the voice, and in the tweaking, then you start one bit of elastic goes.
Yeah, or then, it can get too perfect, I think.
You just totally sanitize it.
That gets way too smooth or something. But this story, like all Rebecca's story in her collection, it focuses on like really minute, like personal interactions. And they're actually quite tricky. Like, I read this story and then I reread it. I think I've read it 3 times now. And I can't, you know, she's having her relationship with her boyfriend, and that's, she's the main character is like quite a funny character. And I love characters like this, because she's demanding that everyone be so sensitive to her, I think, but like, she's not sensitive to really anyone else. Do you know that kind of, I think she's doing really, really small character work that's incredibly hard to do, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And certainly in the first draft, you do get that of somebody who's completely oblivious, who's kind of living on edge. She's sort of frivolous, isn't she, in the first...
But I don't know if in a fun way.
Not in a fun way. No, frivolous in a total, like, oh, don't bother me with that sort of way.
Yeah,
Because she doesn't want to dwell on X, Y, Z. And there's moments now where you can see there's a chance for a little opening here and there. That obviously Rebecca has realised, I need to get across something of the substrate here that I've left out of this first. She was sitting at the back of her mind and was fueling the story. But she realises now, you know, I've got to draw that out of the subconscious. And make it a tiny bit more explicit. And there are moments in the second draft where, we get the slightest hint of it here in the story that herself and her boyfriend James are not exactly a healthy relationship.
No.
And I think Rebecca's decided I need to show that he's a little bit more controlling than he comes across in the first. She's clearly in a bit of a kind of a gaslit, controlling relationship.
And she can't speak to him freely.
She can't speak to him. And he censors her and he picks her up on stuff.
But at the same time, I really feel that something she does quite cleverly is like she doesn't really let her off the hook in the sense that, you know, she's so sensitive to everything he says to her, like how he speaks to her and stuff. But yet she's behaving so badly with the other guy, you know, that like...
Yeah. Well, it's very human, isn't it? It's messy. It's messy and she's kept all that mess in. And yet, of course, she can't help but feel terrible. Maybe she should have just had the fling with the guy at the end.
It's almost more cowardly not to have it.
It's almost because, the boyfriend is obviously a bit of a dick.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's so human and believable. Mm. You know, who hasn't been as flawed as that? Who isn't as flawed as any of these people?
Oh, totally. More flawed.
Who are you talking to? you get the sense like, oh God, you know, they're young and they're making so many mistakes, these people. James hasn't grown up yet. Nathaniel is so immature. He's so pretentious. She has, she's typically kind of underconfident and terrified at this stage of her life, as we all were.
I really, there's something that, because I do this monthly and I talk and I've been reading a lot of stories. And what I love in a short story is when someone like thwarts your expectations. Like everything she does in this is not what I expected to happen. So I loved when she goes on the kind of semi date or what she expects to be a date with Nathaniel. And it's just like, you know, it should feel like sorted or exciting or something. And he's just so boring and pretentious that it surprises her.
Yeah.
I thought that was really, really smart.
I know. It's such a brilliant scenario, isn't it? Again, it's such a simple thing. I don't think I've read that setup before. I don't think I've read that setup before. No, I haven't read everything in the world. But,
what? But I wouldn't have invited you on the podcast.
But like most great stories, they're just very, very simple. They involve two or three characters. If in doubt about what to write, just boil it down to three people and how they interact in very ordinary ways and very real ways. And she's just managed to get something really truthful out of this, partly because of how simple the setup is and partly because of the urgency she's kind of applied to the writing of it.
What do you think of her friend in this? So the guy that comes home from New York, what's his name? Is it James?
Dan.
Is he like, I couldn't work out there. Is he disapproving of her? I think he's kind of condescending to her. I don't think it's one of those friendships I feel that has probably drifted apart and it's just.
Distance has done it for them, hasn't it? A bit. I didn't find him offensively kind of. He's sensitive enough, actually.
I think he's more mature than her.
He is.
Yeah.
And he picks her up on things justifiably, I think.
Yeah.
There's one. Let me see. Can I find it, actually? Yeah. There's one line he says about this little, adventure or fling she's about to embark on with Nathaniel. He says, I'll tell you now. You're going to feel like the biggest asshole in the world if you keep this up. And that's changed. In the second draft, she's taken out the "I tell you now." She says, "You're going to make a fool of yourself if you keep this up." Either way, like however he delivers that, it's, you know, he either says you're going to feel like the biggest asshole in the world if you keep it, and you get the sense it's just he delivers it in that way that friends do. That's not offensive.
Yeah, yeah.
But still, I think she was wise to change it to make a fool of yourself, because, you know, how can he presume to know? He's sense enough. Mm. He's sensitive enough to know that that she might be offended if she sensed that he presumed how she'd feel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That she'd feel guilty.
Yeah.
That she'd feel like an asshole. So instead, she Rebecca changed it to make a fool of yourself, which is objectively true.
She
probably won't, you know.
And I feel like that when she sits there in Lucky's and he is exactly like the Nathaniel guy, is like pretentious and dull and things, I feel like that whole scenario, she does feel foolish, like, you know.
Yeah,
like that is it's punishment enough.
It's so brilliant.
Yeah,
it's so,
yeah.
That scene, and it's even better in the final draft. She draws that out a bit more.
Yeah, yeah.
And the choreography of it. Yeah. In the first draft, there's not much to it, actually, even though it's really well done. But she's scaled it up then again in the final draft, dramatized it a bit more kind of choreography, dialogue. It's a full scene now, and it's great. It's really great, that bit.
But I also think that something she does in that kind of scene in Lucky's is where, I love that it's Lucky's, by the way, but but she her friend is like talking to someone all night. He's comfortable enough in his skin to just be like, I'm talking to this person, I'm giving this person like my full attention.
Yeah.
But she's constantly looking like that. She has that insecure person, like, am I talking to the right person? Like, you know, am I using my time wisely? You know, like,
yeah,
she's so kind of
FOMO. She's afflicted with that.
Yeah, afflicted. And it's like flickery attention and... Yeah,
it's so real, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She captures it so well.
Mm.
And I'll tell you the other thing about it is, what were the words again? Tom's intro is interesting for the talks of the brief, you know, that he gave the writers. So the five words were bed, buried, velvet, river, and father. I didn't notice those words.
I didn't notice that.
You know, if I was given that brief... I didn't know it was going to...
I'd be gearing up towards the
I'd be the river. Like, the river would become this... The river would become this sort of, you know, kind of, like, unifying...
Yeah.
I don't know, this structural divide. It'd be a metaphor, if you like. And I'd be... You know, the whole thing would be... it'd be set beside a river, you know, and it'd be a man walking along a river.
Yeah.
And he'd be stroking his velvet, you know, sporran or whatever.
The velvet jacket is... Well, the velvet is the jacket.
Of course. The pink,
that's quite
the
nice.
Now that you say that. But I can't... Was there a river in it? I mean, she's... It's very, very... She's very subtly kind of buried, to use another one of those words. And the... I don't know which one she's left out. It's all very... very deftly done. Yeah, so they picked those... I'm just reading it over here. Yeah, they picked those words by himself. Danny Denton, another previous editor of The Sting Fly, and Kathy Sweeney randomly picked words out of Kafka's The Judgment, which was written over a single night.
Was it?
And then...
He did well.
Yeah. It's good. It could have got a lot worse, you know. It could have got insect and or cockroach. And then... And then Tom says, I hummed and hawed for a suitable method, but in the end, I just chose the word on the tip of my tongue. And the only one left over there is velvet. So Tom picked. It doesn't surprise me that velvet was on the tip of Tom. I mean, if you've read his first collection, we don't know what we're doing. It's absolutely rammed full of cunnilingus. It doesn't...
First mention of that on the podcast. Congratulations, Gavin. You're going to get a prize.
Do I get a bingo? Yeah. Tom's written. There's three or four references in Tom's first collection.
You'll have to come in here and defend himself.
I'm not attacking him. I'm not. He's written one of the great descriptions of said act. It's become very fashionable to slag off the the Bad Sex Award, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I never feel like, is that still going?
I don't know. It became really, really fashionable to slag it. I thought it was brilliant.
Why? You thought it? Because it was at least fun.
It was fun.
Yeah, I wouldn't care if I won it or anything.
I would care. Yeah, people used to give it, for two or three years, there were all these kind of condemnatory articles about how it's just run by English public school boys snickering between their fingers. And
at least they're laughing.
I thought it was great fun.
It'd be like winning a Razzie or something, you know, going up to accept it.
Exactly. Nobody thinks that your work is any the worse for it.
Yeah.
There was like Ben Oakley is one. I remember there was a Ben Oakley headline. It was when he won at the Guardian, it was like Ben Oakley wins Bad Sex Award for rocket going off scene. But you remember these things, you know.
You can't forget them.
Yeah. But Tom, no, I'm not saying Tom's was bad. No, Tom's a very Tom's good description. It was a very good description.
So this story does something that I'm like fascinated by, and it does it very, really well. She doesn't overstate it, but obviously the guy she's in a relationship with, they can't talk to each other. Like they don't talk properly. Like at any point, like they're like, and so of course, like any kind of like attention she gets from that Nathaniel guy, which just seems to me like, I wasn't even sure if his motivations were that he liked her or whatever. He just seems like, you know, he's only kind of interested in himself or whatever. But she, like the kind of delusion that all her relationships are sustaining, like, you know, her romantic relationship, she's sort of like partly delusional, or even her friendship. There's just like, she's just a little bit delusional the whole way through. She's not confronting anything sort of head on.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard to write that in a very subtle way, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that the kind of pauses for breath all of a sudden that we've been putting the second draft, you know.
Mm.
There were a lot of sort of run-on sentences that added to that sense that she was delusional in the first draft. I always think of a comma as like half a pause for breath. Just you kind of hear that panic and that gulp, you know, and you get the sense she's just racing through just to not confront. And then all of a sudden you get to the second draft and commas become semicolons. Mm. Some of them become full stops.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit more measure about it.
Mm.
And a tiny bit of the sense of that has come out in the second draft. Mm. Just, it's so subtle. It's like, again, I always think of punctuation, like notation, like musical notation. And you're taking it in without even realizing it forces you to read the story a different way. And there's a little bit more... is certainly more self-awareness in the second draft. But you worry for her. The ending is kind of the ending is very
tell us what the ending is.
Well, the ending, she goes from this moment of this very low moment of this would be fling with Nathaniel not working out and feeling so racked with guilt over it and actually ringing James and telling him about it because she feels so bad about it to this kind of like it almost like this kind of very capricious moment and it's a moment of total bathos of just trying to play a practical joke on Dan hiding under his bed to grab his ankle and previously in the story she's tried to play practical jokes and she's so sort of self-doubting and so bad at committing to things that it's all gone wrong.
Yeah.
She's just timing is off.
Yeah.
Her that sort of the purpose is off.
Mm.
So she's trying it again.
Mm.
Almost like her brain has suddenly become deoxygenated, you know, and she's it feels like a moment of madness almost.
Yeah.
And it's worrying.
It is,
You feel worried for her.
But also, I do, everything you said there, like, she doesn't seem able to commit. Like, she just not someone, like, able to push forward. Like, you know, if something were to have happened with Nathaniel, then something else would have to happen. And then, like, a series of events. But she doesn't want anything to happen. Like, I actually found her sort of, like, cowardly in the end.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's not thinking ahead. Mm. She's hoping, you know, she's very little agency, I guess.
Yeah.
A little bit more again at the second draft. But she's hoping for things just to happen and just kind of guide her, you know?
Yeah. When you were teaching, Gavin, did you, like, I just ask you about that a little bit. I know you've done lots of teaching in UCD and UIG, and your students, would they often write stories like this, and how would you guide them?
Yeah. Well, prompts are good.
Mm.
Yeah. As Tom had said to students, a lot of my teaching is about, you know, getting them used to the idea that writing is a practice. It's not a set of theories that necessarily can be applied. You can go through all the kind of tried and tested structures, but it's about, at the end of the day, it's about kind of inducing a state of mind.
Mm.
You know, it's about getting yourself to that place where things work. And I very often use exercises that. Yeah, just, and I get them to keep it simple. You get a lot of students that come in with these high concept ideas. A lot of young people, they read very high concept kind of genre fiction, and a lot of them are trying to world build, and they try to world build in the first chapter. Do you know?
Mm.
And I tell them to calm down. I don't try to discourage them from writing genre fiction. You know, I allow time for them to kind of, for me to figure out, you know, what sort of writer they naturally are or want to be, you know. Well, they clearly want to be, a lot of them want to be genre writers, but, and just to see, are they naturally genre? I like to introduce them to obviously different things as well.
Yeah.
You know, I try to get them to write simple stuff like this, simple settles.
Yeah.
You know, and it actually does boil down in the end to the simple, like, Aristotelian structure of antagonist, protagonist, a third character, as we have here, Colleen, and James, and Nathaniel, and actually Dan here operates like a kind of a Shakespearean fool So just something simple like that. Mm. Tried and tested. Everybody knows how those things work, even if they don't know the theory behind them.
They do know how it works,
yeah.
I totally know what you mean.
Two people with conflicting goals and aims, and they're just kind of rubbing off each other. They're thwarting each other. Mm. One person wants the other thing, and the other person is thwarting the other person. And then you just, even without knowing, you realize, I need a third person here to come in and shake things up a bit.
Mm.
Give the other person knowledge.
Yeah.
And not randomly introduce that person. Have the first person, the protagonist, summon that person, call on that person, or draw that person to them by their own nature. You know, and everybody finds themselves reverting to that, because we all know that kind of story structure. We all the first stories we were told follow that structure, fairy tales and love triangles, things like that. So it's I always say just keep it simple. You can write a story about anything, the simplest thing. It's all about the telling.
I think that's it. I think students always just need to be told, or not just students, like people start, like, you can write about anything. Like, whenever I've been teaching or whatever, I've always had students be like, oh, you know, someone's already written about this, or someone, like, they're afraid to approach a subject because they feel
so,
like,
what?
I'm like, but everything's been written about, you know.
Yeah, everything's been written about. Yeah, you could give two people a really, really detailed synopsis and say, write that, each of you write this.
Yeah.
And each is like trying to second guess the other, what's she doing? Yeah. What's she wrote? And then they'll both be completely different books because it's all about the telling.
Yeah.
And as you find, as you're writing, you start drawing more and more out of yourself and putting that into it anyway, you know.
Yeah.
All you need to do is just get started on something. I started a novel, one of the 10 novels I've started in the last few years, last year, and I'm set in West Cork. I knew I wanted to write something set in West Cork, and I thought I had a great idea, and then like 2 weeks later I read that Neil Jordan is publishing a novel set in West Cork, and I was like, damn, I can't write it now. But it was silly.
Yeah, so
I actually went. I bought the book just to see that we wouldn't be covered there. And after like three chapters, I realized, ridiculous. You know, I wouldn't write like Neil Jordan.
Exactly. But also, like, I feel like you can't do that in Ireland, because if you're like, you know, because there's so many of us that like every single subject is covered in some way. So you have to tread the same ground.
Yeah.
You know,
or just write something utterly universal. in a placeless place.
It's so interesting to me to read this story though, because like, in the context of like, and I wonder if you agree with me on this, but like in the context of like a lot of contemporary like fiction and stories particularly, and then when I go back and I read from something from like the 60s or the 70s or 80s, past times, that like, I just feel like a lot of contemporary fiction is about like indecision. Like nothing really happens here. Whereas like if you go back and you read a short story, I'm always talking about Cheever or whatever, and the character is like, it suggests they're going to have an affair. They have an affair, you know, but I feel like there's this sort of paralysis or this overthinking that just like dictates like a lot of the contemporary fiction that I read, you know.
And how do you feel about it? Do you think it's that it's good because that's true, or do you think it's bad because everybody's copying each other? Do you think it does?
I think it's symptom. Like, I think if when something is so widely written about, I think it's like symptomatic, like of its time. Yeah. Like, I think it is because of right now and something we're all feeling, and maybe because of the title of the book, like therapy, and the way we think about ourselves now and things, and the lack of connection we feel, like the idea that other people are like less real than ourselves or something.
Totally. It becomes totally kind of inculcated, that idea, just through kind of immersion in social media and the dialogue around self-reflection, sort of self-criticism, all that kind of stuff. It just leads to kind of prevarication.
Definitely. And it's so fascinating to read it, because it's just something I've noticed like again and again and again, you know, in books published
There's
right
a
now.
A lot of it, And you could say, well, you know, it's the obvious thing to write about. Because if you're in any way good, it'll be published because there's obviously a market for it, because that's how people are feeling and that's the kind of stuff that's selling. Or my view on it is, you're very brave to write about it because everybody is.
Yeah.
And it is only the really good stuff that is actually getting published and standing out. And Rebecca's one of them.
Yeah, definitely. No, she absolutely is. It's such a great collection. Yeah. So, Gavin, I want to ask you about how you write stories. Like, I know you've written novels.
Yeah.
And I know you've written stories for The Stinging Fly. And you've also written reviews. And actually, you wrote something that I really was fascinated by. So at some point, I don't know when, Declan maybe asked a group of writers to give the worst writing advice they've ever received. And yours was...
Sorry. I can't remember this.
Yours says, have something to say. So you disagreed with the concept of like that a writer must have something to say.
Okay.
And he's like, I agree with you.
Yeah.
That the idea that the writing is...
No, well, the journalists have something to say. You know, writers don't.
Not all of them. But I think you say have something to say. Can you explain this to me? Like,
I took up writing because I had nothing to say.
Exactly. There's a lot of interesting writing.
Yeah, I just wanted to write around. Mm. I got into writing because I actually wanted to just sort of make something of the mess inside of myself, and the mess I made of trying to communicate with people and trying to make some sort of sense of that. And I think that's more interesting because, and I have said this before, I do remember now that I'm talking about it, but good fiction is about the other ways we communicate. It is about intuition and reading people emotionally and body language and all that kind of stuff, and all that sort of stuff. When you're in that place that I talked about, that I tried to get students into, all that stuff kind of does come out, and manifests in some way in your writing. But if you go in, you know, all guns blazing, determined to set the world to right. I mean, I'm not saying that doesn't work, and it does work for some people. George Orwell was a brilliant polemicist, but actually, he was a terrible writer. His sentences were terrible, but he was a brilliant writer. But you know, nowadays I think he'd be edited to hell. You know. It does boil down to kind of taste as well. I love kind of everything works. I love everything novels. I love massive, even if they're small novels in page. I love novels just full of ideas, full of just a mesh of ideas, everything going on. and you can do that with just the barest illusion, with the barest kind of amount of kind of repetition. I never did an English degree, so I'd be a terrible critic because and you're a great critic, but I'd be a terrible critic because I just don't have the lingo. I don't have the literary lingo to describe.
I never did an English degree, Gavin. It's a big secret of mine.
Now we've exposed it. Are you listening, LRB?
I do. I did a film degree. That doesn't.
Yeah. Well, you've got some kind of critical language, but you know what I mean. These big pudding novels, you know, that have everything going on, and you can only write those from the kind of subconscious. You can't plan those. And you can only write them if you're like, okay, I'm open to this idea now. I'm going to get into this space.
Yeah.
And like, you get a month into writing these sort of works. And your whole waking day becomes filled with this idea. It's like a receptor in your brain. You just walk and you're like, anything that passes my field of vision, or anything that comes into my ears, anything that I think is fair game now. I'm gonna scan it for its suitability for this work. You know, see, does it match up to the theme I'm writing.
That's always a very exciting time.
It really is.
It's always when people like shouldn't really like be telling you story. I feel like I'm like my best self when I'm in that, like, because I'm extremely attentive to what everyone is saying to me, because I'm like, I'm going to use that.
Absolutely. It's so exciting. And that you know, that sort of moment you get in the very final stages, you're like a week of signing off the final draft.
Yeah.
And you just, can I make one final change? You know, and it's often like the thing that everybody picks up on in the reviews. That's great, and everybody praises you for it. It's just, you know, it just keeps going to the end. You know, you're just so excited to the moment that it's if you're not already sick of reading it a thousand times, but you know, of adding stuff, you know.
No, definitely. So I want to ask, what other kind of story writers do you like?
Writers?
Yeah. And do you... Yeah.
So I don't regard myself as a short story person.
Did you start by writing stories, or did you start with novels and then...
Yeah, I did. I suppose I did start with stories. But I've written very few, you know. I've written...
How have you found the process of writing?
I've written
them?
Less than 10, I'd say. And only because people have asked me to do them. And I don't think... I think only two or three are any good. And even when I've... You know, when I've handed them in, after people ask me, they're like, this is sort of like embarrassed silence. They're accepting. They're just, they slot them in.
They're
like
not
three,
embarrassed.
Three
they're
stories,
in awed silence.
Three stories from the end of the, you know, of the issue. So I don't even regard myself being very good at it. And I don't know if I'm that interested in it.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm just daunted by it.
Have you found it difficult? Like, do you ever find writing them hard, or do you find it like
because
writing...
I am that kind of person that I said, he's one of those kind of pudding writers.
Yeah.
He just wants to put everything in.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
And that you need space
for that.
It's
really funny,
You need space for that, and you kind of need years for that as well, really, you know?
You can really tell when someone's a put-everything-in writer or a person's a cut-everything writer.
Well, I'm both. I put everything in and then I
then
I
you take it out,
But I'm careful to preserve the good stuff. I'm absolutely fixated on that, you know?
Yeah.
And really afraid of losing good stuff in editing.
Mm. So what story writers do you particularly like or recommend? Or is there anyone that would you return to?
Yeah. Probably everyone said Dennis Johnson at this stage, haven't they? Every man has said Dennis Johnson, probably. Maeve Brennan is really great. Lucia Berlin. God, you've put me on the spot now.
I know.
I mean, everybody, Sean O'Fresh, some of the Irish people, we all disregard now because it's all old hat and that country's in the past. Sean O'Fresh on Liam.
I know,
McCart,
but the thing is, we're very good. We are very good, even though
Irish people, whatever period in history. Yeah. Yes, we are very good.
It's universally acknowledged now.
What else would we be doing? Only kind of sitting awkwardly opposite each other, looking down into our pints and just
muttering.
Talking to each other, muttering and just filling the silence. You know? I find that the last few years, I'm just reading kind of arcana, just history.
Yeah.
I'm reading a lot of history. Holinshed's Chronicles and The Tawn and stuff like that. You read Thomas Kean's The Tawn?
I know, I've never
heard of it. I'm under the spell of The Tawn at the moment. It's really great.
You've written about Flann O'Brien before the Stinging Fly website.
Oh yeah, again, I was asked to do that, yeah.
Is he someone that you feel like is an influence?
I love Flann O'Brien, he's great. He's great. I try not to let him contaminate my work too. Yeah. I probably would never write after reading
Flann O'Brien. I feel like he's not talked about as much anymore.
You're probably right. He's totally out of fashion.
He is a bit unfashionable, totally isn't fashion. He? The Third Policeman is such a great book.
That's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah, I wrote, it was letters. Mm. His collected letters came out maybe 5-6 years ago, more. And I wrote a review of that. Mm. Yeah, that was great. Very revealing.
Yeah. What did it reveal?
Well, he was very hard on himself.
Mm.
Again, very hard on himself. And the things he had to do to make money.
Mm.
You know, you'd think he should have been, if only the Arts Council were around in the 30s, 40s, 50s. He was applying for jobs and sort of admin jobs here and there just to keep going.
Yeah.
Having said that, he was only just about keeping going, and he lived on Belmont Avenue in Donnybrook. So
he was keeping going. And, it was very different.
But you know, and the other thing about that, I'm just remembering, he lived direct. I remember I went to have a look at the house, and it was directly behind the Magdalen Laundry.
Oh, really?
In Donnybrook. Yeah. Directly. The back wall backed onto the Magdalen Laundry, the yard of the Magdalen Laundry. And it never appeared in the letters, any references to the Magdalen Laundry. He wasn't that kind of guy.
Yeah.
He wasn't that sort of writer. Well, he could have written about it, actually.
Yeah.
He could have written about it in Crushkeen Lawn.
Yeah.
Maybe he did.
I feel like he's sort of unfashionable because he's not, his books, like we were saying, that they aren't really about anything. Like, they're about stuff, but they aren't really, they're not self-serious or earnest in any way.
No, just constant trolling.
Yeah. And there's probably not enough of that.
and just washing machine motion. Structures are just so circular and repetitive and like annoying to the point of you know, almost breaking you, and then he goes a bit further with it, and then you start laughing at it. You know, it's he's great. I haven't read him in a long time though.
No, I haven't. I would like to reread him. There's another question I kind of wanted to say about the story. I think this is a great Rebecca story is a great Dublin story. And I feel like, you know, there's a good, like, contemporary, like, I really like when I read about Dublin, it feels very contemporary to me. Like, it feels like how Dublin feels. Like, in Sally's last book, Beautiful Worlds, that felt like Dublin to me.
Yeah.
And you know lots about, I feel like you know a lot about Dublin and Gavin.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to earn a bit, like, no different to Flann O'Brien, I'm trying to earn a bit of money. In the heritage industry at the moment. I do. I love Dublin. I love reading about it. And I love reading about how people capture contemporary Dublin. Yeah. I don't think there's enough love for Dublin among the current generation of
millennials.
I wish they'd all stay. I wish they wouldn't all flee and go.
I know
people have. You're here. I know some people have to go because obviously it's just
absurdly expensive.
But I feel also if they could afford to stay. Even they would go because it's kind of like it's become part of the life cycle of an Irish person, hasn't it?
To leave
because we're a little island. Yeah. We're a massive island. We're the 20th largest island in the world, but we're a small country. And you know, to have that sort of rite of passage.
But every
10 years it just sucks the life out of Dublin. All the best people just go.
I know, all the best ones, and I'm still here.
You're still here.
I'm not one of the best ones. I do feel that even like right now. Like obviously when I left college, everyone emigrated. A large amount of friends of mine emigrated and I left for a little while and came back. But I feel like it's happening again. Like anyone younger I know now is in their 20s is leaving or has left.
Yeah. It's very sad.
It's very sad.
It's sad for the people who leave and it's sad, although they'll probably have the time of their lives.
Yeah.
Well, it's sad for the people who leave because they have to leave. I'll put it that way. And it's sad for those of us left behind. It's out of the city of Dublin.
It is.
Dublin never gets going. You just think it's getting going. Never, things close.
Yeah, and I also think like, you know, you need young people. Like even absolutely. Like you were saying there about like launches and you need that energy. Like I feel like it's such a waste. It's such a disappointment.
It's such a waste.
Yeah.
And I mean a lot of it is the fault of it's almost wholly the fault of government and it's the fault of the city council, dreadful city council who make our public spaces as ugly and as dysfunctional as they possibly can, and it's the fault of government because the city's dead because it's hollowed out because there's nobody living in it. And to sustain anything in the city centre you need people living in the city.
There's no living in it
apart from the really desperate people in tenements as bad as there were in the 1910s.
I know, and
in the north inner city,
empty office blocks.
I mean, we should be built. What we should do? I'm all for a high rise. I think we should build an office district on the docks. Put 10 towers up there. Put every business that currently occupies. Office space and the Georgian houses in the city centre out there and just get everybody back into the Georgian houses, retrofit offices, you know, get everybody living in the city centre again and make it a vibrant place like every other city in Europe.
It's crazy when you go somewhere like Paris or wherever and you walk around and it just feels like the difference is that it feels like people live there. Like,
totally.
Like even in like the cafes and things in every kind of district or whatever, you're just like, people live here. It's not just tourists here.
Yeah.
Like I can tell it's families and everything. It makes such a large difference.
And above shops as well.
Yeah.
I was in Turin recently and Utrecht, amazing city in the Netherlands not so long ago. Everybody is just living in above.
Yeah.
So much life, the streets, you're walking along the street, there's people hanging their washing out, there's people watering their flowers on their beautiful balconies.
Yeah.
Planning enforcement is a thing in these cities. Everybody has the same. There's none of those horrible PVC windows in historical buildings. Every building has the same, window type windows, window frames, and beautiful shutters, and everything is just so well presented. It's easy to do. You know, these are not necessarily wealthy cities.
Yeah.
Well, Utrecht is, but you know, somewhere like the south of Italy, Palermo isn't or. Lisbon isn't.
Yeah. But I do feel like I don't know what you mean about like I'm always giving out about them, but like the walking, like I walk into the city most days and it's just so like some parts of it are just so ugly. Like I just don't know how it's happened.
Yeah,
you know?
It's just poor regulation. Yeah. Just Dublin City Council have no eye for aesthetics.
Mm.
Just anything is allowed to open anywhere.
Yeah.
Do you know? And it's always, it's across so many, like Carol's gift stores and Dr. Quirky's and Circle K. It's a rash of these places everywhere.
Yeah.
And Spar with their, you know, the sticker transfer on the windows, the woman eating the massive strawberry, you know, everywhere. You can't,
Love her.
Well, I'd like her in my pic. I'd like that transfer on my bedroom wall, but not on the street. And just closing. Everything is closed off. Just really ugly.
Have you ever written a letter of complaint to Dublin City Council?
All the time. I'm an absolute crank.
I'm a total crank. And I'm getting cranky.
Well, I'm hoping to shake them up from the inside now.
I'm hoping to be
the kind of lay my eggs under their skin and then just destroy them.
I'll help you. On that note, we should say thank you so much, Gavin. It's an absolute pleasure. And thank you for your close reading of Rebecca's story. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it, or if you're new to the podcast, please subscribe. The Great Big Giant Short Story Experiment will be taking place on the 22nd of June, and you can find out more information on stingingfly.org. It's devised by Dunleary County Council emerging writer in residence Sonia Galdi and the Stinging Fly. The Great Big Giant Short Story Experiment, it's like a tongue twister, is a day-long, in-depth and interactive exploration of the short story form with writers Wendy Erskine, Sheila Armstrong, Stephen Sexton, and Daniel McLaughlin.
I taught Sonia.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh.
I could see her sitting in the class thinking, who is this bozo teaching me?
Not at all. We'll be back next month with a recording from our first ever live episode. I'll be in conversation with Keelan Hughes on the 28th of April at 1 p.m. in the Tyle Hall Theatre in Galway as part of the Cork International Literary Festival. If you'd like to attend, tickets are available on cork.ie. Access to the Stingfly's full archive is available to everyone who subscribes to the magazine and to our patrons. Taking out a subscription is a great way to support what we do. I want to thank the Arts Council, who provide funding for this podcast, and for everything else that the Stingfly is doing to seek out, nurture, publish, and promote the very best new writers and new writing. Thank you for listening. Until next time.